How one flower makes room for another, all bunching but not blocking the sun? Lord Feringhal did turn his gaze from Miralda to regard the myriad flowers, and a strange expression of revelation came over his face.
You do see,
Miralda remarked after a long, long silence. Lord Feringhal continued to study the color surrounding them. He turned back to Miralda, a look of wonder in his eyes.
I have lived here all my life, he said. And in those years, no, decades, this garden has been here. Yet never before have I seen it. It took you to show me the beauty.
He came nearer to Miralda and took her hand in his, then leaned in and gently kissed her, though not urgently and demandingly as he had done their previous evening. He was gentle and appreciative.
Thank you,
he said, as he pulled back from her. Miralda managed a weak smile in reply.
Well, you should be thanking your sister, she said. A load of work to get it this way.
I shall,
Lord Feringhal replied unconvincingly. Miralda smiled knowingly and turned her attention back to the garden, thinking again how grand it would be to walk through the place with Jacka at her side. The amorous young lord was beside her again, so close, his hands upon her, and she could not maintain the fantasy. Instead, she focused on the flowers, thinking that if she could just lose herself in their beauty, just stare at them until the sun went down, and even after, in the soft glow of the moon, she might survive this night. To his credit, Lord Feringhal allowed her a long, long while to simply stand quietly and stare. The sun disappeared and the moon came up, and though it was full in the sky, the garden lost some of its luster and enchantment, except for the continuing aroma mixing sweetly with the salty air.
"Won't you look at me all the night?"
Feringhal asked, gently turning her around.
"I was just thinking,"
Miralda replied.
"Tell me your thoughts,"
he eagerly prompted. The woman shrugged.
"Silly ones only,"
she replied. Lord Feringhal's face brightened with a wide smile.
"I'll wager you are thinking it would be grand to walk among these flowers every day," he ventured. "To come to this place whenever you desired, by sun or by moon, in winter even, to stare at the cold waters and the bergs as they build in the north."
Miralda was wiser than to openly deny the guess, or to add to it that she would only think of such things if another man, her Jacka, was beside her instead of Lord Feringhal.
"Because you can have all of that,"
Feringhal said excitedly.
"You can, you know, all of it and more."
"You hardly know me," the girl exclaimed,
near to panic and hardly believing what she was hearing.
"Oh, but I do, my Miralda,"
Feringhal declared, and he fell to one knee, holding her hand in one of his and stroking it gently with the other.
"I do know you, for I've looked for you all my life."
"You're speaking foolishness,"
Miralda muttered, but Feringhal pressed on.
"I wondered if ever I would find the woman who could so steal my heart," he said,
and he seemed to Miralda to be talking as much to himself as to her.
"Others have been paraded before me, of course. Many merchants would desire to create a safe haven in Orkney by bartering their daughters as my wife, but none gave me pause."
He rose dramatically, moving to the sea wall.
"None,"
he repeated. Feringhal turned back, his eyes boring into hers.
"Until I saw the vision of Miralda. With all my heart, I know that there is no other woman in all the world I would have as a wife."
Miralda stammered over that one, stunned by the man's forwardness, by the sheer speed at which he was trying to move this courtship. Even as she stood trying to think of something to reply, he enveloped her, kissing her again and again, not gently, pressing his lips hard against hers, his hands running over her back.
"I must have you," he said, nearly pulling her off balance.
Miralda brought her arm up between them, slamming her palm hard into Lord Feringhal's face and driving him back a step. She pulled away, but he pressed in again.
"Please, Miralda," he cried, "my blood boils within me."
"You're saying you want me for a wife, but you're treating me like a harlot," she cried. "No man takes a wife he's already bedded,"
Miralda pleaded. Lord Feringhal skidded to a stop.
"But why?" said the naive young man. "It is love, after all, and so it is right, I say. My blood boils, and my heart pounds in my chest for want of you."
Miralda looked around desperately for escape, and found one from an unexpected source.
"Your pardon, my lord,"
came a voice from the door, and the pair turned to see Steward Temegast stepping from the castle.
"I heard the cry, and feared that one of you might have slipped over the rail."
"Well, you see that is not the case, so begone with you,"
an exasperated Feringhal replied, waving his hand dismissively and turning back to Miralda. Steward Temegast stared at her frightened white face for a long while, a look of sympathy upon his own.
"My lord," he ventured calmly, "if you are indeed serious about marrying this woman, then you must treat her like a lady."
"The hour grows long," he announced. "The Ganderlay family will be expecting the return of their child. I will summon the carriage."
"Not yet,"
Lord Feringhal replied immediately, before Temegast could even turn around.
"Please,"
he said, more quietly and calmly, to Temegast, but mostly to Miralda.
"A short while longer?"
Temegast looked to Miralda, who reluctantly nodded her assent.
"I will return for you soon," Temegast said,
and he went back into the castle.
"I'll have no more of your foolery,"
Miralda warned her eager suitor, taking confidence in his sheepish plea.
"It is difficult for me, Miralda,"
he tried sincerely to explain,
"more than you can understand. I think about you day and night. I grow impatient for the day when we shall be wed, the day when you shall give yourself to me fully."
Miralda had no reply, but she had to work hard to keep any expression of anger from appearing on her fair face. She thought of her mother then, remembered a conversation she had overheard between her father and a woman friend of the family, when the woman bemoaned that Beasta likely would not live out the winter if they could find no better shelter or no cleric or skilled healer to tend her.
"I'll not wait long, I assure you,"
Lord Feringhal went on.
"I will tell Priscilla to make the arrangements this very night."
"I haven't even said I would marry you,"
Miralda squealed a weak protest.
"But you will marry me, of course,"
Feringhal said confidently.
"All the village will be in attendance, a fair that will stay in hearts and memories for all the lives of all who witness it. On that day, Miralda, it will be you whom they rejoice in most of all,"
he said, coming over and taking her hand again, but gently and respectfully this time.
"Years, no, decades from now, the village women will still remark on the beauty of Lord Feringhal's bride."
Miralda couldn't deny she was touched by the man's sincerity, and somewhat thrilled by the prospect of having as great a day as Feringhal spoke of, a wedding that would be the talk of Orkney for years and years to come. What woman would not desire such a thing? Yet, Miralda also could not deny that while the glorious wedding was appealing, her heart longed for another. She was beginning to notice another side of Lord Feringhal now. A decent and caring nature, perhaps, buried beneath the trappings of his sheltered upbringing. Despite that, Miralda could not forget, even for one moment, that Lord Feringhal simply was not her Jacka. Steward Temegast returned and announced that the coach was ready, and Miralda went straight to him. But she was still not quick enough to dodge the young man's last attempt to steal a kiss. It hardly mattered. Miralda was beginning to see things clearly now, and she understood her responsibility to her family and would put that responsibility above all else. Still, there was a long and miserable ride across the bridge and down the road, the young woman's head swirling with so many conflicting thoughts and emotions. Once again, she bade the gnomish driver to let her out some distance from her home. Pulling off the uncomfortable shoes Temegast had sent along with the dress, Miralda walked barefoot down the lane under the moon. Too confused by the events, to think that she was to be married, Miralda was barely conscious of her surroundings and wasn't even hoping, as she had after her first meeting, that Jacka would find her on the road. She was taken completely by surprise when the young man appeared before her.
"What did he do to you?"
Jacka asked before Miralda could even say his name.
"Do?"
she echoed.
"What did you do?"
Jacka demanded.
"You were there for a long time."
"We walked in the garden,"
the woman answered.
"Just walked?"
Jacka's voice took on a frightful edge at that moment, one that set Miralda back on her heels.
"What are you thinking?"
she dared ask. Jacka gave a great sigh and spun away.
"I am not thinking, and that is the problem," he wailed. "What enchantment have you cast upon me, Miralda? All the bewitching! I know miserable Ferengo must feel the same," he added, spinning back on her. "What man could not?"
A great smile erupted on the young woman's face. But it didn't hold, not at all. Why was Jacka acting so peculiar, so love-struck all of a sudden, she wondered? Why hadn't he behaved this way before?
"Did he have you?"
Jacka asked, coming very close.
"Did you let him?"
The questions hit Miralda like a wet towel across the face.
"How can you be asking me such a thing?"
she protested. Jacka fell to his knees before her, taking both her hands and pressing them against his cheek.
"Because I shall die to think of you with him,"
he explained. Miralda felt weak in her knees and sick to her stomach. She was too young and too inexperienced, she realized, and could not fathom any of this, not the marriage, not Lord Ferengel's polite and almost animalistic polarities, and not Jacka's sudden conversion to lovesick suitor.
She started. "We did nothing. Oh, he stole a kiss, but I didn't kiss him back."
Jacka looked at her. And the smile upon his face was somehow unnerving to Miralda. He came closer then, moving his lips to brush against hers and lighting fires everywhere in her body, it seemed. She felt his hands roaming her body, and she did not fear them, at least not in the same manner in which she had feared her noble suitor. No, this time it was an exciting thing, but still she pushed the man back from her.
"Do you deny the love that we feel for each other?"
a wounded Jacka asked.
"But it's not about how we're feeling,"
Miralda tried to explain.
"Of course it is,"
the young man said quietly, and he came forward again.
"That is all that matters."
He kissed her gently again, and Miralda found that she believed him. The only thing in all the world that mattered at that moment was how she and Jacka felt for each other. She returned the kiss, falling deeper and deeper, tumbling away to an abyss of joy. Then he was gone from her too abruptly. Miralda popped open her eyes to see Jacka tumbling to the ground, a raging Doni Ganderlay standing before her.
"Are you a fool, then?"
the man asked, and he lifted his arm as if to strike Miralda. A look of pain crossed his rugged face then, and he quickly put his arm down, but it came up again, grabbing Miralda roughly by the shoulder and spinning her toward the house. Doni shoved her along, then turned on Jacka, who put his hands up defensively in front of his face and darted about trying to escape.
"Don't hit him, Da!"
the young woman cried, and that plea alone stopped Doni.
"Stay far from my girl,"
Doni warned Jacka.
"I love—"
Jacka started to reply.
"They'll find your body washing on the beach,"
Doni said. When Miralda cried out again, the imposing man turned on her viciously.
"Home!"
he commanded. Miralda ran off at full speed, not even bothering to retrieve the shoe she had dropped when Doni had shoved her. Doni turned on Jacka, his eyes red from anger and nights of restless sleep, as menacing as any sight the young man had ever witnessed. Jacka turned on his heel and ran away. He started to anyway, for before he had gone 3 steps, Doni hit him with a flying tackle across the back of his knees, dropping him face down on the ground.
"Miralda begged you not to hit me," the terrified young man pleaded. Donnie climbed atop him, roughly pulling the young man over. "Miralda's not knowing what's best for Miralda," Donnie answered with a growl and a punch that jerked Jacka's head to the side. The young man began to cry and to flail his arms wildly, trying to fend off Donnie. The blows got through, though, one after another, swelling Jacka's pretty eyes and fattening both his lips, knocking one tooth out of his perfect smile and bringing blue bruises to his normally rosy cheeks. Jacka finally had the sense to bring his arms down across his battered face. But Donnie, his rage not yet played out, only aimed his blows lower, pounding Jacka about the chest. Every time Jacka dropped one arm down lower to block there, Donnie cunningly slipped a punch in around his face again. Finally, Donnie leaped off the man, grabbed him by the front of the shirt, and hoisted him to his feet with a sudden, vicious jerk. Jacka held his palms out in front of him in a sign of surrender. That cowardly act only made Donnie slug him one more time, a brutal hook across the jaw that sent the young man flying to the ground again. Donnie pulled him upright, and he cocked his arm once more. Jacka's whimper made Donnie think of Miralda, of the inevitable look upon her face when he walked in, his knuckles all bloody. He grabbed Jacka in both hands and whipped him around, sending him running on his way.
"Get yourself gone!" the man growled at Jacka. "And don't be sniffing about my girl again!"
Jacka gave a great wail and stumbled off into the darkness.
Chapter 9 The Barrel's Bottom. Robillard scratched his chin when he saw the pair, Wolfgar and Morrick, moving down the alley toward the front door of the Cutlass. Dutermont was still inside, a fact that did not sit well with the divining wizard, given all the activity he had seen outside the tavern's door. Robillard had watched a seedy character come out and pay off a street urchin. The wizard understood the uses of such children. That same character, an unusual figure indeed, had exited the Cutlass again and moved off into the shadows. Wolfgar appeared with a small, swarthy man. Robillard was not surprised when the same street urchin peeked out from an alley some distance away, no doubt waiting for his opportunity to return to his chosen place of business. Robillard realized the truth after putting the facts together and adding a heavy dose of justifiable suspicion. He turned to the door and chanted a simple spell, grabbing at the air and using it to blast open the portal. "Mr. McCanty," he called, amplifying his voice with yet another spell. "Go out with a pair of crewmen and alert the town guard," Robillard demanded. "To the Cutlass on Half Moon Street with all speed." With a growl, the wizard reversed his first spell and slammed the door shut again, then fell back intently into the images within the crystal ball, focusing on the front door of the Cutlass. He moved inside to find Dutermont leaning calmly against the bar. A few uneventful moments passed, and Robillard shifted his gaze back outside just long enough to note Wolfgar and his small friend lurking in the shadows, as if waiting for something. Even as the wizard's roving magical eye moved back through the tavern's door, he found Dutermont approaching the exit.
"Hurry, McCanty," Robillard mouthed quietly. But he knew that the town guard, well drilled as they were, wouldn't likely arrive in time and that he would have to take some action. The wizard plotted his course quickly, a dimensional door to the other end of the docks and a second to the alley that ran beside the Cutlass. One final look into the crystal ball showed Dutermont walking out and Wolfgar and the other man moving toward him. Robillard let go his mental connection with the ball and brought up the first dimensional door. Creeps Sharky and Tianiknik crouched in the shadows on the rooftop. The tattooed man brought the blowgun up to his lips the second Dutermont exited the tavern.
"Not yet,"
Creeps instructed, grabbing the barrel and pulling the weapon low.
"Let him talk to Wolfgar and Morrick, and get near to my stone that'll kill any magical protections he might be wearing. And let others see him together, afore and when Dutermont falls dead."
The wretched pirate licked his lips in anticipation.
"They gets the blame, we gets the booty," he said.
Wolfgar,
Captain Dudermont greeted him when the barbarian and his sidekick shifted out of the shadows and steadily approached.
My men said you came to see Sprite. Not from any desire, Wulfgar muttered, drawing an elbow from Morik.
You said you want your warhammer back, the little man quietly reminded him.
What Morik was really thinking, though, was that this might be the perfect time for him to learn more about Dudermont, about the man's protections and, more importantly, his weaknesses. The street urchin had found the barbarian and the rogue down by the docks, handing over the small bag and its curious contents, and explaining that Captain Dudermont desired their presence in front of the cutlass on Half Moon Street. Again, Morik had spoken to Wulfgar about the potential gain here, but he backed off immediately as soon as he recognized that dangerous scowl. If Wulfgar would not go along with the assassination, then Morik meant to find a way to do it on his own. He had nothing against Dudermont, of course, and wasn't usually a murderer, but the payoff was just too great to ignore. Good enough for Wulfgar, Morik figured, when he was living in luxury, the finest rooms, the finest food, the finest booze, and the finest horse. Wulfgar nodded and strode right up to stand before Dudermont, though he did not bother accepting the man's offered hand.
"What do you know?"
he asked.
"Only that you came to the docks and looked up at Waylon McCanty," Dudermont replied. "I assume that you wish to speak with me." "All that I want from you is information concerning Aegis Fang," he said sourly. "Your hammer?" Dudermont asked, and he looked curiously at Wulfgar, as if only then noticing that the barbarian was not wearing the weapon.
"The boy said you had information," Morik clarified.
"Boy?" the confused captain asked.
"The boy who gave me this,"
Morik explained, holding up the bag. Dudermont moved to take it, but stopped, seeing Robillard rushing out of the alley to the side.
"Hold!" the wizard cried.
Dudermont felt a sharp sting on the side of his neck. He reached up instinctively with his hand to grab at it, but before his fingers closed around the cat's claw, a great darkness overcame him, buckling his knees. Wulfgar leaped ahead to grab him. Robillard yelled and reached out magically for Wulfgar, extending a wand and blasting the huge barbarian square in the chest with a gob of sticky goo that knocked him back against the cutlass and held him there. Morik turned and ran.
"Captain! Captain!" Robillard cried, and he let fly another glob for Morik, but the agile thief was too quick and managed to dodge aside as he skittered down another alley. He had to reverse direction almost immediately, for entering the other end came a pair of city guard, brandishing flaming torches and gleaming swords. He did keep his wits about him enough to toss the satchel the boy had given him into a cubby at the side of the alley before he turned away. All of Half Moon Street seemed to erupt in a frenzy then, with guardsmen and crewmen of Sea Sprite exiting from every conceivable angle. Against the wall of the cutlass, Wulfgar struggled mightily to draw breath. His mind whirled back to the grayness of the abyss, back to some of the similar magic the demon Ertu had put on him to hold him so, helpless in the face of diabolical minions. That vision lent him rage, and that rage lent him strength. The frantic barbarian got his balance and pulled hard, tearing planking from the side of the building. Robillard, howling with frustration and fear as he knelt over the scarcely breathing Dudermont, hit Wulfgar with another glob, pasting him to the wall again. "They've killed him," the wizard yelled to the guardsman. "Catch the little rat!"
"We go,"
Tia Nicknick said as soon as Dudermont's legs buckled.
"Hit him again,"
Creeps begged. The tattooed man shook his head.
"One enough. We go."
Even as he and Creep started to move, the guards descended upon Half Moon Street and all the other avenues around the area. Creeps led his friend to the shadows by a dormer on the building, where they deposited the blowgun and poison. They moved to another dormer across the way and sat down with their backs against the wall. Creeps took out a bottle, and the pair started drinking, pretending to be oblivious, happy drunks. Within a few moments, a trio of guardsmen came over the lip of the roof and approached them. after a cursory inspection, and a cry from below revealing that one of the assassins had been captured and the other was running loose through the streets, the guards turned away in disgust. Morik spun and darted one way, then another, but the noose was closing around him. He found a shadow in the nook of a building and thought he might wait the pursuit out, when he began glowing with magical light.
"Wizards," the rogue muttered. "I hate wizards."
Off he ran to a building and started to climb, but he was caught by the legs and hauled down, then beaten and kicked until he stopped squirming.
"I did nothing," he protested, spitting blood with every word as they hauled him roughly to his feet.
"Shut your mouth," one guard demanded, jamming the hilt of his sword into Morik's gut, doubling the rogue over in pain. He half-walked and was half-dragged back to where Robillard worked feverishly over Dudermont.
"Run for a healer," the wizard instructed, and a guard and a pair of crewmen took off.
"What poison?" the wizard demanded of Morik. Morik shrugged as if he did not understand.
"The bag," said Robillard. "You held a bag."
"I have no—" Morik started to say, but he lost the words as the guard beside him slammed him hard in the belly yet again.
"Retrace his steps," Robillard instructed the other guards. "He carried a small satchel. I want it found."
"What of him?"
one of the guards asked, motioning to the mound of flesh that was Wolfgar.
"Surely he can't breathe under that."
"Cut his face free, then," Robillard hissed. "He should not die as easily as that."
"Captain,"
Waylon McCanty cried upon seeing Dudermont. He ran to kneel beside his fallen captain. Robillard put a comforting hand on the man's shoulder, turning a violent glare on Morik.
"I am innocent," the little thief declared, but even as he did, a cry came from the alley. A moment later, a guardsman ran out with a satchel in hand.
Robillard pulled open the bag, first lifting the stone from it and sensing immediately what it might be. He had lived through the time of troubles, after all, and he knew all about dead magic regions and how stones from such places might dispel any magic near them. If his guess was right, it would explain how Morik and Wolfgar had so easily penetrated the wards he'd placed on the captain. Next, Robillard lifted a cat's claw from the bag. He led Morik's gaze and the stares of all the others from that curious item to Dudermont's neck, then produced another, similar claw, the one he had pulled from the captain's wound.
"Indeed," Robillard said dryly, eyebrows raised. "I hate wizards," Morik muttered under his breath.
A sputter from Wolfgar turned them all around. The big man was coughing out pieces of a sticky substance. He started roaring in rage almost immediately and began tugging with such ferocity that all the cutlass shook from the thrashing. Robillard noted then that Aram Gardpeck and several others had exited the place and stood staring incredulously at the scene before them. The tavern keeper walked over to consider Wolfgar, then shook his head.
"What have ye done?" he asked.
"No good as usual," remarked Josie Puddles.
Robillard walked over to them.
"You know this man?"
he asked Aram, jerking his head toward Wolfgar.
"He's worked for me since he came to Luskin last spring," Aram explained, "until—"
The tavern keeper hesitated and stared at the big man yet again, shaking his head.
"Until—" Robillard prompted. "Until he got too angry with all the world,"
Josie Puddles was happy to put in.
"You will be summoned to speak against him before the magistrates," Robillard explained. "Both of you."
Aram nodded dutifully, but Josie's head bobbed eagerly, perhaps too eagerly, Robillard observed, but he had to privately admit his gratitude to the little wretch. A host of priests came running soon after, their numbers and haste alone a testament to the great reputation of the pirate-hunting Captain Dudermont. In mere moments, the stricken man was borne away on a litter. On a nearby rooftop, Creeps Sharky smiled as he handed the empty bottle to Tia Nicknick. Luskin's jail consisted of a series of caves beside the harbor, winding and muddy, with hard and jagged stone walls. Perpetually stoked fires kept the place brutally hot and steamy. Thick veils of moisture erupted wherever the hot air collided with the cold, encroaching waters of the Sword Coast. There were a few cells, reserved for political prisoners mostly, threats to the ruling families, and merchants who might grow stronger if they were made martyrs. Most of the prisoners, though, didn't last long enough to be afforded cells, soon to be victims of the macabre and brutally efficient Prisoner's Carnival. This revolving group's cell consisted of a pair of shackles, set high enough on the wall to keep them on the tips of their toes, dangling agonizingly by their arms. Compounding that torture were the mindless jailers, huge and ugly thugs, half-ogres mostly, walking slowly and methodically through the complex with glowing pokers in their hands.
"This is all a huge mistake, you understand,"
Morik complained to the most recent jailer to move in his and Wolfgar's direction. The huge brute gave a slow chuckle that sounded like stones grating together and casually jabbed the orange end of a poker at Morik's belly. The nimble thief leaped sidelong, pulling hard with his chained arm but still taking a painful burn on the side. The ogre jailer just kept on walking, approaching Wolfgar and chuckling slowly.
"And what of yourself?"
the brute said, moving his smelly breath close to the barbarian.
"Yourself as well, eh? Ne'er did nothing deserving such imprisoning?"
Wolfgar, his face blank, stared straight ahead. He barely winced when the powerful brute slugged him in the gut. Or when that awful poker slapped against his armpit, sending wispy smoke from his skin.
"Strong one,"
the brute said and chuckled again.
"More fun's all."
He brought the poker up level with Wolfgar's face and began moving it slowly in toward the big man's eye.
"Oh, but ye'll howl," he said.
"But we have not been tried," Morik complained.
"You're thinking that matters?"
the jailer replied, pausing long enough only to turn a toothy grin on Morik.
"You're all guilty for the fun of it, if not the truth."
That struck Wolfgar as a profound statement. Such was justice. He looked at the jailer as if acknowledging the ugly creature for the first time, seeing simple wisdom there, a viewpoint come from observation. From the mouth of idiots, he thought. The poker moved in, but Wolfgar set the jailer with such a calm and devastating stare, a look born of the barbarian's supreme confidence that this man, that all these foolish mortal men, could do nothing to him to rival the agonies he had suffered at the clawed hands of the demon heir to. The jailer apparently got that message, or a similar one, for he hesitated, even backed the poker up so he could more clearly view Wolfgar's set expression.
"You think ye can hold it?"
the brutal torturer asked Wolfgar.
"You think ye can keep your face all stuck like that when I pokes your eye?"
And on he came again. Wolfgar gave a growl that came from somewhere very, very deep within. A feral, primal sound that stole the words from Morik's mouth as the little thief was about to protest. A growl that came from his torment in the pits of the abyss. The barbarian swelled his chest mightily, gathered his strength, and drove one shoulder forward with such ferocity and speed that the shackle anchor exploded from the wall, sending the stunned jailer skittering back.
"Oh, but I'll kill ye for that!"
the half-ogre cried, and he came ahead brandishing the poker like a club. Wolfgar was ready for him. The barbarian coiled around, almost turning to face the wall, then swung his free arm wide, the chain and block of metal and stone fixed to its other end, swishing across to clip the glowing poker and tear it from the jailer's hand. Again the brute skittered back, and this time Wolfgar turned back on the wall fully, running his legs right up it so that he had his feet planted firmly, one on either side of the remaining shackle.
"Knock all the walls down," Morik cheered.
The jailer turned and ran. Another growl came from Wolfgar, and he pulled with all his strength, every muscle in his powerful body straining. This anchor was more secure than the last, the stone wall more solid around it. But so great was Wolfgar's pull that a link in the heavy chain began to separate.
"Pull on," Morik cried.
Wolfgar did, and he was sailing out from the wall, spinning into a back somersault. He tumbled down unhurt, but then it hit him. A wave of anguish more powerful than any torture the sadistic jailer might bring. In his mind, he was no longer in the dungeon of Luskin, but back in the abyss, and though no shackles now held him, he knew there could be no escape, no victory over his two powerful captors. How many times had Ertu played this trick on him, making him think he was free, only to snare him and drag him back to the stench and filth, only to beat him, then heal him and beat him some more?
"Wolfgar," Morik begged repeatedly, pulling at his own shackles, though with no results at all.
"Wolfgar!"
The barbarian couldn't hear him, couldn't even see him, so lost was he in the swirling fog of his own thoughts. Wolfgar curled up on the floor, trembling like a babe when the jailer returned with a dozen comrades. A short while later, the beaten Wolfgar was hanging again from the wall, this time in shackles meant for a giant, thick and solid chains that had his feet dangling several feet from the floor, and his arms stretched out straight to the side. As an extra precaution, a block of sharpened spikes had been set behind the barbarian, so if he pulled hard, he would impale himself rather than tug the chains from their anchors. He was in a different chamber now, far removed from Morik. He was all alone with his memories of the abyss, with no place to hide, no bottle to take him away.
"It should be working," the old woman grumbled. "Right herbs for the poison."
Three priests walked back and forth in the room, one muttering prayers, another going from one side of Captain Dudermont to the other, listening for breath, for a heartbeat, checking for a pulse, while the third just kept rubbing his hand over his tightly cropped hair.
"But it is not working," Robillard argued, and he looked to the priests for some help.
"I don't understand," said Camerbun, the ranking cleric among the trio. "It resists our spells and even a powerful herbal antidote."
"And with some of the poison in hand, it should be working," said the old woman.
"If that is indeed some of the poison," Robillard remarked.
"You yourself took it from the little one called Morik,"
Camerbun explained.
"That does not necessarily mean..."
Robillard started to reply. He let the thought hang in the air. The expressions on the faces of his four companions told him well enough that they had caught on.
"What do we do then?"
the wizard asked.
"I can no be promising anything,"
the old woman claimed, throwing up her hands dramatically.
"With none of the poison, me herbs'll do what they will."
She moved to the side of the room, where they had placed a small table to act as her workbench, and began fiddling with different vials and jars and bottles. Robillard looked to Camerbun. The man returned a defeated expression. The clerics had worked tirelessly over Dudermont in the day he had been in their care, casting spells that should have neutralized the vicious poison flowing through him. Those spells had provided temporary relief only, slowing the poison and allowing the captain to breathe more easily and lowering his fever a bit at least. Dudermont had not opened his eyes since the attack. Soon after, the captain's breathing went back to raspy, and he began bleeding again from his gums and his eyes. Robillard was no healer, but he had seen enough death to understand that if they did not come up with something soon, his beloved Captain Dudermont would fade away.
"Evil poison," Camerbun remarked.
"It is an herb, no doubt," Robillard said. "Neither evil nor malicious. It just is what it is."
Camerbun shook his head.
"There is a touch of magic about it. Do not doubt, good wizard," he declared. "Our spells will defeat any natural poison. No, this one has been specially prepared by a master, and with the help of dark magic."
"Then what can we do?" the wizard asked.
"We can keep casting our spells over him, to try and offer as much comfort as possible, and hope that the poison works its way out of him,"
Camerbun explained.
"We can hope that old Gretchen finds the right mixture of herbs."
"'Easier it'd be if I had a bit of a poison,'
old Gretchen complained.
"'And we can pray,'
Kammerbund finished. The last statement brought a frown to the atheistic Robillard. He was a man of logic and specified rules, and did not indulge in prayer.
"'I will go to Morik the Rogue and learn more of the poison,' Robillard said with a snarl. "'He has been tortured already,'
Kammerbund assured the wizard.
"'I doubt that he knows anything at all. It is merely something he purchased on the street, no doubt.'
"'Tortured?' Robillard replied skeptically.
"'A thumbscrew, a rack? No, that is not torture. That is a sadistic game and nothing more. The art of torture becomes ever more exquisite when magic is applied.'
He started for the door, but Kammerbund caught him by the arm.
"'Morik will not know,' he said again,
staring soberly into the outraged wizard's hollowed eyes.
"'Stay with us. Stay with your captain. He may not survive the night, and if he does come out of the sleep before he dies, it would be better if he found a friend waiting for him.'
Robillard had no argument against that heavy-handed comment, so he sighed and moved back to his chair, plopping down. A short while later, a city guardsman knocked and entered the room, the routine call from the magistrate.
"'Tell Jerem Ball and old Jarkeld that the charge against Wulfgar and Morik will likely be heinous murder,'
Kammerbund quietly explained. Robillard heard the priest, and the words sank his heart even lower. It didn't matter much to Wulfgar and Morik what charge was placed against them. Either way, whether it was heinous murder or intended murder, they would be executed. Though with the former the process would take much longer, to the pleasure of the crowd at the prisoner's carnival. Watching them die would be of little satisfaction to Robillard, though, if his beloved captain did not survive. He put his head in his hands, considering again that he should go to Morik and punish the man with spell after spell until he broke down and revealed the type of poison that had been used. Kammerbund was right, Robillard knew, for he understood city thieves like Morik the Rogue. Certainly Morik hadn't brewed the poison, but had merely gotten some of it from a well-paid source. The wizard lifted his head from his hands, a look of revelation on his haggard face. He remembered the two men who had been in the cutlass before Wulfgar and Morik had arrived, the two men who had gone to the boy who had subsequently run off to find Wulfgar and Morik, the grimy sailor and his exotic tattooed companion. He remembered Leaping Lady sailing out fast from Luskin's harbor. Had Wulfgar and Morik traded the barbarian's marvelous warhammer for the poison to kill Dudermont? Robillard sprang up from his chair, not certain of where to begin, but thinking now that he was on to something important. Someone, either the pair who had signaled Dudermont's arrival, the street urchin they had paid to go get Wulfgar and Morik, or someone on Leaping Lady knew the secrets of the poison. Robillard took another look at his poor, bedraggled captain, so obviously near to death. He stormed out of the room, determined to get some answers. Chapter 10 Passage Meralda walked tentatively into the kitchen the next morning, conscious of the stare her father leveled her way. She looked to her mother as well, seeking some indication that her father had told the woman about her indiscretion with Jacka the previous night. But Beasta was beaming, oblivious.
"'Oh, the garden!'
Beasta cried, all smiles.
"'Tell me about the garden. Is it as pretty as Gertie Hawkins says?'
Meralda glanced at her father. Relieved to find him smiling as well, she took her seat and moved it right beside Beasta's chair.
"'Prettier,' she said, her grin wide. "'All the colors, even in the late sun. And under the moon, though it's not shining so bright, the smells catch and hold you.' "'That's not all that caught my fancy,'
Meralda said, forcing a cheerful voice as she launched into the news they were all waiting to hear.
"'Lord Feringhal has asked me to marry him.'
Beasta squealed with glee. Tori let out a cry of surprise, and a good portion of her mouthful of food as well. Donny Ganderly slammed his hands upon the table happily. Beasta, who could hardly get out of bed the 10 day before, rushed about, readying herself, insisting that she had to go out at once and tell all of her friends, particularly Gertie Hawkins, who was always acting so superior because she sometimes sewed dresses for Lady Priscilla.
"Why'd you come in last night so flustered and crying?"
Tori asked Beralda as soon as the two were alone in their room.
"Just mind what concerns you,"
Beralda answered.
"You'll be living in the castle, and traveling to Hundlestone and Fireshire, and even to Luskin and all the wondrous places,"
pressed Tori, insisting.
"But you were crying. I heard you."
Eyes moistening again, Miralda glared at the girl, then went back to her chores.
"It's Jacka,"
Tori reasoned, a grin spreading across her face.
"You're still thinking about him."
Miralda paused in fluffing her pillow, moved it close to her for a moment, a gesture that revealed to Tori her guess was true, then spun suddenly and launched the pillow into Tori's face, following it with a tackle that brought her sister down on the small bed.
"Say I'm the queen," the older girl demanded. "You just might be," stubborn Tori shot back, which made Miralda tickle her all the more.
Soon Tori could take it no more and called out, "Queen, queen," repeatedly.
"But you are sad about Jacka,"
Tori said soberly a few moments later, when Miralda had gone back to fixing the bedclothes.
"I saw him last night,"
Miralda admitted,
"on my way home. He's gone sick thinking about me and Lord Faringal."
Tori gasped and swayed, then leaned closer, hanging on every word.
"He kissed me, too. Better than Lord Faringal?"
Miralda sighed and nodded, closing her eyes as she lost herself in the memory of that one brief, tender moment with Jacka.
"Oh, Miralda, what are you to do?"
Tori asked.
"Jacka wants me to run away with him,"
she answered. Tori moaned and hugged her pillow.
"And will you?"
Miralda stood straighter then, and flashed the young girl a brave smile.
"My place is with Lord Faringal,"
she explained.
"But Jacka can't do nothing for Ma, and nothing for the rest of you,"
Miralda went on.
"You can give your heart to whomever you want, but you give your life to the one who's best for you and for the ones you love."
Tori started to protest again, but Donny Ganderly entered the room.
"You got work," he reminded them.
And he put a look over Miralda that told the young woman that he had indeed overheard the conversation. He even gave a slight nod of approval before exiting the room. Miralda walked through that day in a fog, trying to align her heart with acceptance of her responsibility. She wanted to do what was right for her family, she really did. But she could not ignore the pull of her heart, the desire to learn the ways of love in the arms of a man she truly loved. Out in the fields higher on the carved steps of the mountain, Donny Ganderlay was no less torn. He saw Jacka Schooley that morning, and the two didn't exchange more than a quick glance, one-eyed for Jacka, whose left orb was swollen shut. As much as Donny wanted to throttle the young man for jeopardizing his family, he could not deny his own memories of young love, memories that made him feel guilty looking at the beaten Jacka. Something more insistent than responsibility had pulled Jacka and Miralda together the previous night. And Donny reminded himself pointedly not to hold a grudge, either against his daughter or against Jacka, whose only crime, as far as Donny knew, was to love Miralda. The house was quiet, and perfectly still in the darkness just after dusk, which only amplified the noise made by every one of Miralda's movements. The family had retired early after a long day of work, and the excitement of Miralda receiving yet another invitation to the castle 3 days hence, accompanied by the most beautiful green silk gown the Ganderlay women had ever seen. Miralda tried to put the gown on quietly and slowly, but the material ruffled and crackled.
"What are you doing?"
came a sleepy whisper from Tori. "Shh," Miralda replied, moving right beside the girl's bed and kneeling so that Tori could hear her whispered reply.
"Go back to sleep and keep your mouth shut,"
she instructed.
"You're going to Jacka,"
Tori exclaimed, and Miralda slapped her hand over the girl's mouth.
"No such thing," Miralda protested. "I'm just trying it out." "No, you're not," said Tori, coming fully awake and sitting up. "You're going to see Jacka. Tell me true, or I'll yell for Da." "Promise me that you'll not say,"
Miralda said, sitting on the bed beside her sister. Tori's head bobbed excitedly.
"I'm hoping to find Jacka out there in the dark," Miralda explained. "He goes out every night to watch the moon and the stars." "And you're running away to be married?"
Miralda gave a sad chuckle.
"No, not that," she replied. "I'm giving my life to Lord Feringle, for the good of Ma and Da and yourself," she explained. "And not with regrets," she added quickly, seeing her sister about to protest. "No. He'll give me a good life at the castle, of that I'm sure. He's not a bad man, though he has much to learn. But I'm taking tonight for my own heart. One night with Jacka to say goodbye."
Miralda patted Tori's arm as she stood to leave.
"Now go back to sleep." "Only if you promise to tell me everything tomorrow,"
Tori replied.
"Promise or I'll tell." "You won't tell,"
Miralda said with confidence, for she understood that Tori was as enchanted by the romance of it all as she was. More, perhaps, for the young girl didn't understand the lifelong implications of these decisions as much as Miralda did.
"Go to sleep,"
Miralda said softly again, as she kissed Tori on the forehead. Straightening the dress with a nervous glance toward the curtained door of the room, Miralda headed for the small window and out into the night. Donny Ganderlay watched his eldest daughter disappear into the darkness, knowing full well her intent. A huge part of him wanted to follow her, to catch her with Jacka and kill the troublesome boy once and for all. But Donny also held faith that his daughter would return, that she would do what was right for the family, as she had said to her sister that morning. It tore at his heart, to be sure, for he understood the allure and insistence of young love. He decided to give her this one night, without question and without judgment. Miralda walked through the dark in fear. Not of any monsters that might leap out at her. No, this was her home, and the young woman had never been afraid of such things. But of the reaction of her parents, particularly her father, if they discovered her missing. Soon enough, though, the woman left her house behind and fell into the allure of the sparkling, starry sky. She came to a field and began spinning and dancing, enjoying the touch of the wet grass on her bare feet, feeling as if she were stretching up to the heavens above to join with those magical points of light. She sang softly to herself, a quiet tune that sounded spiritual and surely fit her feelings out here, alone, at peace, and as one with the stars. She hardly thought of Lord Feringle, of her parents, of her responsibility, even of her beloved Jacka. She wasn't thinking at all, was just existing in the glory of the night, and the dance. "Why are you here?" came a question from behind her, Jacka's lisping voice. The magic vanished, and Miralda slowly turned around to face the young man. He stood, hands in pockets, head down, curly brown hair flopping over his brow so that she couldn't even see his eyes. Suddenly, another fear gripped the young woman. The fear of what she anticipated would happen this night with this man. "Did Lord Feringle let you out?" Jacka asked sarcastically.
I'm no puppet of his,
Miralda replied.
Are you not to be his wife?
Jacka demanded. He looked up and stared hard at the woman, taking some satisfaction in the moisture that glistened in her eyes.
That's what the villagers are saying,
he went on. Then he changed his voice.
Lorel de Gandelay, he cackled, sounding like an old gnome woman. Oh, but a lucky one she is, to think that Lord Feringel himself had come a-calling for her.
Stop it,
Miralda begged softly. Jacka only went on more forcefully, his voice shifting timbre.
Then what's he thinking, that fool Feringel? He said, now in the gruff tones of a village man. He'll bring disgrace to us all, marrying so low as that. And what, with 100 pretty and rich merchant girls begging for his hand? Ah, the fool!
Miralda turned away, and suddenly felt more silly than beautiful in her green gown. She also felt a hand on her shoulder, and Jacka was there behind her.
You have to know,
he said softly.
Half of them think Lord Feringel a fool, and the other half are too blind by the false hopes of it all. Like they're reliving their own courtships through you, wishing that their own miserable lives could be more like yours.
What are you thinking?
Miralda said firmly, turning around to face the man, and starting as she did to see more clearly the bruises on his face, his fat lip and closed eye. She composed herself at once, though understanding well enough where Jacka had found that beating.
I think that Lord Feringel believes himself to be above you,
Jacka answered bluntly.
And so he is.
No!
The retort came out sharply, making Miralda jump back in surprise.
No, he is not your better,
Jacka went on quietly. And he lifted his hand to gently stroke Miralda's wet cheek.
Rather, you are too good for him.
But he will not view things that way. Nay, he will use you at his whim, then cast you aside.
Miralda wanted to argue, but she wasn't sure the young man was wrong. It didn't matter, though, for whatever Lord Feringel had in mind for her, the things he could do for her family remained paramount.
Why did you come out here?
Jacka asked again, and it seemed to Miralda as if he only then noticed her gown, for he ran the material of one puffy sleeve through his thumb and index finger, feeling its quality.
I came out for a night for Miralda,
the young woman explained.
For a night when my desires would outweigh me responsibility. One night.
She stopped when Jacka put a finger over her lips, holding it there for a long while.
Desires?
He asked slyly.
And do you include me among them?
Do you come out here all finely dressed just to see me?
Miralda nodded slowly. And before she had even finished, Jacka was against her, pressing his lips to hers, kissing her hungrily, passionately. She felt as if she were floating, and then she realized that Jacka was guiding her down to the soft grass, holding the kiss all the way. His hands continued to move about her, and she didn't stop them, didn't even stiffen when they brushed her in private places. No, this was her night, the night she would become a woman with the man of her choosing, the man of her desires and not her responsibilities. Jacka reached down and pulled the gown halfway up her legs and wasted no time in putting his own legs between hers.
Slower, please,
Miralda said softly, taking his face in both her hands and holding him very close to her so that he had to look in her eyes.
I want it to be perfect,
she explained.
Miralda,
the young man breathed, seeming desperate.
I cannot wait another minute. You don't have to,
the young woman assured him, and she pulled him close and kissed him gently. Soon after, the pair lay side by side, naked on the wet grass, the chill ocean air tickling their bodies as they stared up at the starry canopy. Miralda felt different, giddy and lightheaded almost, and somehow spiritual, as if she had just gone through something magical, some rite of passage. A thousand thoughts swirled in her mind. How could she go back to Lord Feringal after this wondrous lovemaking with Jacka? How could she turn her back on these feelings of pure joy and warmth? She felt wonderful at that moment, and she wanted the moment to last and last for the rest of her life. The rest of her life with Jacka. But it would not, the woman knew. It would be gone with the break of dawn, never to return. She'd had her one moment. A lump caught in her throat. For Jacka Schooley, the moment was a bit different, though certainly no less satisfying. He had taken Miralda's virginity, had beaten the Lord of Orkney himself to that special place. He, a lowly peasant in Lord Feringal's eyes, had taken something from Feringal that could never be replaced, something more valuable than all the gold and gems in Castle Ork. Jacka liked that feeling, but he feared, as did Miralda, that this afterglow would not last. "Will you marry him?" he asked suddenly. Beautiful in the moonlight, Miralda turned a sleepy eye his way. "Let's not be talking about such things tonight," the woman implored him. "Nothing about Lord Feringal or anyone else."
"I must know, Miralda,"
Jacka said firmly, sitting up to stare down at her.
"Tell me."
Miralda gave the young man the most plaintive look he had ever seen.
"He can do for my ma and da,"
she tried to explain.
"You must understand that the choice is not mine to make."
An increasingly desperate Miralda finished lamely.
"Understand?"
Jacka echoed incredulously, leaping to his feet and walking away.
"Understand? How can I after what we just did? Oh, why did you come to me if you planned to marry Lord Feringal?"
Miralda caught up to him and grabbed him by the shoulders.
"I came out for one night where I might choose," she explained. "I came out because I love you and wish with all my heart that things could be different."
"We had just one brief moment,"
Jacka whined, turning back to face her. Miralda came up on her tiptoes and kissed him gently.
"We've more time,"
she explained, an offer Jacka couldn't resist. A short while later, Jacka was lying on the grass again, while Miralda stood beside him, pulling on her clothes.
"Deny him,"
Jacka said unexpectedly, and the young woman stopped and stared down at him.
"Deny Lord Feringal,"
Jacka said again, as casually as if it were the most simple decision.
"Forget him and run away with me, to Luskin, or even all the way to Waterdeep."
Miralda sighed and shook her head.
"I'm begging you not to ask it of me,"
she started to say, but Jacka would not relent.
"Think of the life we might find together," he said, "running through the streets of Waterdeep, magical Waterdeep. Running and laughing and making love, raising a family together, how beautiful our children shall be." "Stop it,"
Miralda snapped so forcefully that she stole the words from Jacka's mouth.
"You know I want to, and you also know I can't."
Miralda sighed again profoundly. It was the toughest thing she had ever done in her entire life, but she bent to kiss Jacka's angry mouth one last time, then started toward home. Jacka lay on the field for a long while, his mind racing. He had achieved his conquest, and it had been as sweet as he had expected. Still, it would not hold. Lord Feringal would marry Miralda, would beat him in the end. The thought of it made him sick. He stared up at the moon, now shaded behind lines of swift-moving clouds.
"Fie this life,"
he grumbled. There had to be something he could do to beat Lord Feringal, something to pull Miranda back to him. A confident smile spread over Jacka's undeniably handsome face. He remembered the sounds Miralda had made, the way her body had moved in harmony with his own. He wouldn't lose.
Chapter 11 All Hands Joined.
"You will tell me of the poison," said Prelate Volton, an associate of Camerbun. He was sitting in a comfortable chair in the middle of the brutally hot room, his frame outlined by the glow of the huge blazing hearth behind him.
"Never good," Morik replied, drawing another twist of the thumbscrew from the bulky, sadistic, one-eyed, and he didn't even bother to wear an eye patch, jailer. This one had more orcish blood than human.
"Poison, I mean,"
the rogue clarified, his voice going tight as waves of agony shot up his arm.
"It was not the same as the poison in the vial," Volton explained,
and he nodded to the jailer, who walked around the back of Morik.